Call to order the Conference Committee on Senate File 4062 between the Senate Environmental Natural Resource Committee and our counterparts on the House. Welcome, everybody. This is day three, I think, of the Conference Committee. We've had some great discussion, I think, over the last 2 years with regards to points that are in the bill. Today, we're going to have a couple other different testifiers come forward and talk about the other side. Specifically, I think probably what got the most, some of the most time yesterday was the PFAS. And we're going to have some testifiers talk about what the regulations would mean to them. And we'd open it up for questions. And I find that substance quite interesting. It seems like it's all over the place. But anyhow, we'll do that. In your packets, I think you had handouts. You may want to refer to those. Several different ones that came in with regards to our bill here. So if you get time in your spare time between running here and there this time of the year, please take a look at those. They've put a lot of work into that. So with that, Mr. Chair, go ahead. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Ingebrigtsen. Just procedurally, since we're in hybrid, are we supposed to address the computer or to talk into the microphone? Talk into the microphone?
Yeah, I believe so. So, and I think everybody else is also into the...
And I think, Mr. Chair, we have two of our members that will be remote today and then one of the nonpartisan staff. So maybe just a moment as if they are going to be speaking to make sure they can get the input.
Absolutely. And we have a couple members that are also going to be remote. And but other than that, I think we're in pretty good shape. And we will take the time to answer any questions that we have. So, members, what we're going to start out with here is... The Chamber of Commerce. I don't know if Mr. Quillis, there you are. Mr. Quillis, if you're here, certainly identify yourself. Welcome to the committee. And if you would refer to parts of the bill that your organization is concerned about, we appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tony Quillis, and I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And for this afternoon, I think I'm just going to focus on Article 4 of the House file dealing with PFAS in general, Mr. Chairman. You had, as you noted, a lengthy conversation about the issue yesterday. And I just wanted to kind of give you a 10,000-foot look down, if you will, at the issue from my perspective and then some state and federal activity that is ongoing. But right now, Mr. Chairman, there are over 4,000 chemicals in the PFAS class structure. They don't all have the same toxicological effects. Their hazard and risk files are different for each of these chemicals and each of their use. They have a wide range of applications, and they have different properties and different characteristics. They're known for their resistance to grease, oil, water, and heat, and they provide flexibility and strength and durability for the products that they're used in. There are upwards of 6,000 uses for this product. It's used in such things as medical devices and MRI machines, automobiles, manufacturing processes, airplanes, solar panels, and cell phones are just some of the uses of this chemical. Mr. Chairman, one size fits all is not a way and an approach to apply this regulation to this chemical class. It's too big and it's too diverse. There's a lot of activity going on right now on the state and federal level, Mr. Chairman. EPA Administrator Reagan at the EPA has a PFAS roadmap Right now, they're reviewing effluent limitation guidelines, risk assessments for this chemical. They're going to issue disposal and guidance documents. Additionally, they have a data review that we touched on a little bit yesterday of 20 specific PFAS applications. And all of that I just mentioned is going to be acted on in 2022 or early 2023. Here on the state level, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has released their blueprint. Also on the state level, we have fish tissue sampling in regards to PFAS going on right now. We've amended state contracts on purchasing compostable products with PFAS. The PCA is right now implementing their draft monitoring plan and has requests into industrial municipal facilities, airports, landfills, and wastewater treatment plants on whether they have PFAS at their facilities or in the process of the manufacturing facilities. The last year, Senator Weber, in the final compromise bill last year, had $600,000 for the Pollution Control Agency to create a PFAS stakeholder group to look at PFAS and wastewater and landfills. That group is to identify sources of PFAS. They're supposed to identify source reduction strategies, provide guidance and education documents, and identify items for future study. That report is due back here in January 31st of 2023 before this body. Mr. Chairman, I'm a member of that committee. As Mr. Kadelka pointed out yesterday, we've had two or three meetings already, and we've taken a pause right now. We have a request for a proposal out for a consultant to help us through those four things I just identified, and I'm not sure where that is in the process, but I'm sure we'll start meeting again here soon. Where there are alternatives, the industry has been moving towards them. But not all the products in all applications have alternatives, and not all of the alternatives have been tested. But where there is alternatives and they've been tested, the industry is moving there. And the example would be last year for food packaging, where there is an alternative and we move forward on that, Mr. Chairman. But not all of these PFAS chemicals also have health-based values or health risk limits tied to them either. This issue can't be solved just on the state or local level or by banning individual products. Mr. Chairman, in regards to the all the individual bills that are in Article 4, just a quick review of them is there's no de minimis language included in any of them. There's no intentionally added language or what I call the manufacturer retail lag, where there's a stop date for a manufacturer of the product and then a stop date for the retail sale of the lag of the product. So, Mr. Chairman, I think we literally have put the proverbial cart before the horse with all this activity on the state and federal level before it's completed, before we move forward on any of this. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll wrap up. I know you've got some other people to testify, and I'll stick around for any questions. But there are letters in your packet, I think, from the Personal Care Products Association as well as from the Minnesota Retailers Association expressing their concerns also.
So I think in the interest of allowing you to move on to your next function, we'll go ahead and open it up for questions of the members. If you have any questions with regards to the testifier's testimony. Representative Wozlik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some comments and then a question or two here. So first, I sort of want to respond to, I know we've had this ongoing conversation in previous committee hearings when we've heard the various PFAS bills, but I sort of want to respond to some of the things that I heard. So first, we're not banning all uses of PFAS with this bill. We have very specific products that we're going after, products that have really close contact with consumers. So we're not trying to ban all uses. We're not trying to ban the use in medical devices or all these other things that are really important. I also just want to address the point about regulating PFAS as a class of chemicals. There have been concerns raised to that issue several times in committees, and sort of the reasoning behind regulating these chemicals as a class is because, one, they have similar properties, and as I've said earlier, I think I said this yesterday, research has shown that even the newer PFAS chemicals, which were supposed to be safer, are actually linked to negative health effects. So one of the things that we have to keep in mind when we're regulating chemicals, whether it's as a class or not as a class, if we regulate them as a class, then we can prevent those regrettable substitutions, which is essentially what's happened with these newer PFAS chemicals, saying we're going to substitute these in for these bad ones. They're not actually found to be much better than the bad ones in terms of the health impacts. It's also a way for us to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of chemical management and to encourage different ways that when we know that it's all PFAS, when we're doing that cleanup, that we can clean up all of that chemical and it's not just one or the other and that sort of thing. I would also say, I think testing was mentioned. It would take decades or even centuries. How quickly the EPA tests chemicals to test every single PFAS chemical in existence. And while we wait for that testing to be done and we wait for the EPA to do things, these chemicals are gonna continue to be used in products, and they're gonna continue to contaminate the environment and accumulate in our bodies. I think my concern, I understand the concerns that Mr. Quillis is raising. My concern is that it's gonna take a long time and a lot of money to clean up the current PFAS contamination, and all we're doing by delaying this is adding more contamination when we allow these chemicals to keep being used. So one thing I wanted to point out too, is there's a lot of focus on the feds. And one thing that we know about the feds is that the EPA, if there's an election, presidential election, the EPA, the people that manage the EPA change. So if there's a Democratic administration or Republican administration, what we saw in the Trump administration was that they essentially put the kibosh on anything related to PFAS. So they didn't want to tackle the issue. The EPA didn't want to tackle that issue on the federal level when they had a different administration. So I just want to be clear that while I understand these concerns, they're also, it's not the entire story of these concerns. And I want to make sure that we're sort of addressing those things. One question I do have for Mr. Quillis, I don't know if he knows the answer to this or not, is what is the, I guess, I know you're the Minnesota Chamber specifically, but what is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce? Where are they at on PFAS? What are their positions on various things? Do you have an idea?
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wozwick, I don't know off the top of my head. I'd be glad to find out what their position is, but off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you.
Representative Wozwick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Quillis. So what I will say is what I do know about the U.S. Chamber is that they actually oppose the PFAS Action Act. They actively oppose this, and what this would have done was listed PFAS as a hazardous substance, and it would have aided in our efforts to clean up PFAS contamination. And I want to point out that the reason they oppose this, they can say what they want, but the reason they oppose this is because they have members that don't want to be accountable for the contamination that their products have caused. You know, the Trump EPA killed many PFAS proposals. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has lobbied against PFAS issues on the federal level. So I find it hard to believe that we're saying we should do things at the federal level because whatever, whatever, when they're lobbying against this on the federal level, and the EPA and past administrations has also killed PFAS regulations. So I think as a state, Minnesota can take action. We can take action and put into law these things so that regardless of what the chamber lobbies on at the federal level, regardless of what the EPA, whether that changes with administrations, that we actually have, we're taking action in our state to do this. I think that it's really important to note that if we're not banning it, who ends up paying for this? And it's either taxpayers who are going to see increases in drinking water rates because companies don't want to pay for the cleanup, and taxpayers have to, what we're seeing is that we have to spend money to sue. So suing 3M, for example, and other companies that create these chemicals, that costs taxpayers money. And I think there's a way that we can come together and work on language in these provisions and get support from Senate Republicans, from House DFLers and House Republicans and Senate DFLers in this conference committee to really move forward on this issue. It's a big one, Senator Ingebrigtsen, as you said, PFAS is everywhere. And the answer is not let's just wait till the feds do something. The answer is let's do something about it now. So appreciate the time that you've been here, Tony, Mr. Quillis, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe what I'll do is I'll follow up with a question. Mr. Quillis, You don't know where the National Chamber stands on this. Can you tell me about where our neighboring states are with PFAS most recently? Have they seen similar legislation, I guess is what I'm asking.
Mr. Chairman, it'd be hard for me to comment, but on my research looking at some of the bills that we've looked at in terms of carpets, textiles, cosmetics, cookware, ski wax, I have not seen, if you look at our surrounding states, and I'm just going to say North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, that I have seen anything that has passed the legislature in those surrounding states.
Okay. Chair Hansen.
If there are others online, I can wait.
Representative Morrison. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it strikes me that we have this same theme going on that we've talked about on other days, where as we learn new information, we have to pivot and adjust our behavior and change. I don't think anyone introduced PFAS hoping to do harm, but we have since learned that it is harmful and it is now ubiquitous. And so I'm wondering if this is sort of a blanket, we don't want to do anything around PFAS from the chamber, or if, you know, for example, the provision to ban it in cosmetics. I know many people, myself included, who use mascara, for example, and I would rather not have some PFAS that close to my eye. I think most people would probably be okay with removing that from cosmetics. And I'm wondering if we look at it kind of piece by piece, would the chamber and would you, Mr. Chair, be open, for example, to banning its use in cosmetics?
Was that directed at me? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, that was directed at you and Mr. Quillis.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, obviously, I happen to think there needs to be a lot more research, but the question and I'll let Mr. Quillis answer, then I have a question for you, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrison, you know, I've looked at a number of bills that have been talked about in other states, specifically California, Maryland, and Maine, and there are different approaches on how they look at this. There's also some federal action right now with Senator Susan Collins and Representative Dingell looking at this on a larger level. But there is also, you know, to go back to Representative Wasilewicz too, there are, please understand where I pointed out today and said, where there is opportunities, and if there is hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars being spent by industry right now, trying to find alternatives, and once they find those alternatives, to get them approved by the federal level. It's not that people aren't looking at this and understand where the market is going, whether it be cosmetics, cookware, juvenile products. People, industry itself are spending, like I said, millions, if not billions of dollars in research and development right now to try and find alternatives. But in every single case, in every single application, sometimes they're not there. And whether what the use of the product is it encapsulated inside plastic? Is it exposed to touch, human fingers touch? So there's different applications, different processes for it, Representative Morrison and Representative Wasilewicz. But in terms of cosmetics, I think that a number of the major manufacturers, and I'm not going to try and go through and list them all, because I'm not a cosmetic purchaser, but I know that a number of major manufacturers have been trying to find alternatives to it, and I think they have in some cases. So, Mr. Chairman, that would be my answer.
Yeah, thank you. And you know, it just sounds to me like other things that we've seen in the past, where if you seem to want to legislate in a little bit in a hurry, it seems like the industry kind of takes that ball and starts to roll with it, and pretty soon you have products that are different. But when we're talking about it not being safe, Representative Morrison, I know you're a doctor. When you talk about how harmful this is, can you dive in a little deeper as to how truly harmful PFAS is in the human body? And maybe you don't want to answer that question.
But I wasn't sure if it was my turn to go. Thank you, yeah. Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly not a researcher in PFAS. I think our resident expert actually is Representative Wasloik. But, you know, there was an article, I think it was in the Duluth paper yesterday. They've called for advising people to not eat more than a single meal of smelt per month because of the levels of PFAS in the smelt. There is a whole body of research around the health impacts of PFAS, and they include heart health and immune suppression. There's concerns around in pregnancy and in children. And we know as we work to figure out how to remove PFAS from the environment, it strikes me that we should be doing everything we can to stop adding PFAS to the environment. So I guess that would be my response, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Well, the smelt thing is certainly interesting. I'm wondering if the same report is there for lutefisk. I'm not sure whether you can comment on that or not, because I'd be interested in that. But Representative Wasloik, would you like to add a little more with regards to the health effects of PFAS?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I wanted to add a little more on that and then to reply to the comment about what other states are doing. When it comes to the health impacts, there has been a lot of research more so on the older PFAS chemicals, the PFOA and the PFOS. Recent research has shown that even the newer generation of PFAS chemicals are problematic. And one of the things that's most problematic in my mind is that, these chemicals, are being transferred to babies, from mother to child through umbilical cord blood and breastfeeding. So, little babies are starting out with this chemical in their blood. And what we know about it, because it bioaccumulates, is it doesn't just go away once it's there, it builds up. So I think that's one of the key health pieces that is really important to know, is that this is a chemical that bioaccumulates in human bodies. There's been quite a bit of research, though, on PFAS chemicals. Recent study has shown exposure to certain PFAS can lead to endocrine disruption in pregnant women and their fetuses. We're seeing, links to pregnancy-induced hypertension, liver damage, increased cholesterol, increased risk of thyroid disease, decreased antibody response to vaccines, increased risk of asthma, decreased fertility, and decreased birth rate. So these are all things that the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry at the CDC, sort of a place where some of this research comes together, have shown that PFAS might be linked to these conditions. So it is a really important piece. The other thing I wanted to notice, there was actually the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences conducted a 28-day toxicity study comparing 7 different PFAS chemicals. This was in 2019. And these studies show that the current use PFAS, the newer PFAS that were introduced after the old ones were phased out because they were found to have negative health impacts, actually induced similar toxicity as the phased out PFAS. So we're not finding necessarily exactly the same things in the new PFAS as the old PFAS, but we are finding that they are causing issues. I did want to highlight what the state of Wisconsin is doing, since that was brought up in the conversation. The state of Wisconsin actually put out a comprehensive plan similar to our PFAS blueprint. And part of, they went through a process where they had a lot of public engagement. And banning or phasing out PFAS use and PFAS-containing products was one of the most commonly address topics in comments received from the public during this initial public outreach that happened in February 2020. So, constituents, citizens of Wisconsin are looking for these sorts of legislative things to happen. And in the action, what is sort of recommended that the state of Wisconsin do based on these comments and other information, what's happening in other states, is that they actually pursue legislation requiring responsible product stewardship and comprehensive labeling, so that people know what's in these products. Right now, that's not a requirement. And then also, whether or not they should pursue bans, more broad bans on PFAS use in these in these items. So that's sort of what Wisconsin's doing right now, and that's some work that's been done by an organization there on this issue. I'm not sure what what the DNR or anyone else is doing, but I do know they have they also have an advisory, a fish advisory, because of the PFAS contamination. So just wanted to throw that out there as what other states are sort of following the lead of having this broader comprehensive plan, to getting that together, and Wisconsin is doing that and pursuing some of the same things.
Well, thank you. It's very clear that you, you've done your work on this, and the talk about the term PFAS group, the PFAS, or I guess it would be anti-PFAS group that you refer to, and maybe I misunderstood you, but you even talked about if we don't change, there'll come a lawsuit, and I guess that kind of logic is for anything and everything nowadays. So, Mr. Quillis, I'm wondering, what would be the actual dollar impact to the consumers if these, as they call, very few changes here were to be made? Do you have any idea financially?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, unfortunately, no, I don't. And I think it would be hard to put a fiscal impact on whether or not how the industry would deal with it, or whether they would even sell products here in the state dealing with carpet, textiles, cookware, cosmetics, juvenile products, ski wax. It'd be kind of tough, Mr. Chairman, to put a financial impact on that.
Okay. Mr. Lippert. Representative Lippert, there you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to circle back to the point about industry taking the ball and rolling with it, so to speak. I mean, I think what often happens with industry is that they don't move as quickly as they possibly can or as creatively as they possibly can until some regulations start coming into place as well, that we see that pressure provided by the state signaling that this is a chemical concern and we need to act. Motivates industry to move even more quickly. It shapes the direction that the market's going to be going. And I think we have some very focused proposals here, like with banning PFAS in ski wax, for example, that would take steps in improving our safety, but also providing that signal. So I, for example, have a daughter who's on the Nordic team and would ski wax her skis on a regular basis, be skiing or waxing before every race, didn't recognize that she was handling a substance that wasn't completely safe. And I think many Minnesotans would be feeling that way too as they learn more and more about PFAS. So I think these are some simple targeted steps we can take that would improve safety and also send a clear signal to industry that we need this change as rapidly as possible.
Representative Hess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Quillis, I was listening very closely to what you said, and it appears that part of your concern, there were two issues that may make some opportunity for common ground. One was including intentionally added in terms of any of these proposals to state that the PFAS that is being used or that would be prohibited in use would be intentionally added, to have a prohibition on that versus the way the language is currently written. And if I remember last year correctly, Mr. Chair, that's what we did on the food packaging. We had intentionally added in the conference committee, and then that was able to be a moment of common ground and passage. Secondly, I heard you say about a staggered timeline for the ending of production and then the ending of retail of the particular product that had PFAS in it, so that the manufacturers stop, I'll just off the top of my head say, January 1st, 2023, and the retail stops January 1st, 2024. Did I hear that correctly, that those are a couple of the concerns that you have? Is it that laddering of removing the topic or removing the product from commerce should have some steps, and that intentionally added should be one of the things that you would suggest?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, every bill that I have looked at dealing with this issue in various states is including intentionally added in it. And you're right, that was a discussion we had last year with food packaging. And so that was number one concern for me, is the intentionally added language, because other states, as well as other things that we passed here in Minnesota, always include that language. In terms of the manufacturer retail sale lag, we usually put that in there too, because it's just kind of hard to go through and say, you have to stop making ski wax on January 1st. Well, there's probably some on the shelf somewhere up at Lutzen or at Spirit Mountain. So that drop dead state, I mean, we usually have a sell through. We have a stop manufacturer and then a sell through. But Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, those are just two of a long list of concerns I have with all of the sections in Article 4.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Quillis, I listened very closely to what you just said, and you said to all of the sections in Article 4. So you have a menu of sections here, and it would seem, following up on what Representative Lippert said, I think most Minnesotans didn't know that there was PFAS in ski wax. They thought that ski wax was ski wax. What did we do before PFAS? We used wax. And there is an alternative there. Now, I don't think PFAS and ski wax is an essential product that every Minnesotan needs. So of all of these things, if you had a ladder out on the usage and intentionally added, would you still oppose that prohibition on ski wax? Or is that something we can find common ground on? Because if we can, I would have Representative Wasilick work with the chair or whoever is a designated person on the Senate side to try to find some common ground that we could get at least some accomplishment here to reduce the amount of PFAS in the environment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, are you just talking about ski wax or are you talking about all of Article 4?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I just asked about ski wax.
Mr. Gross.
I'd have to go back and look and find it in here, Mr. Chairman. But like I said, there the sell-through, then go through and look at the intentionally added. And I'd have to look, and I'm going to apologize, I don't have my notes with me on the ski wax right now, on what the other concerns were there. But I know that I had a couple more other than those two on ski wax. The other ones, juvenile products, carpets and textiles and cosmetics, were the length, the list was a little bit longer, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Representative Hansen.
Just looking for a little progress here, Mr. Quillis, and I think our team is willing to talk and try to find some common ground.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also was listening very closely, Mr. Quillis. And you talked briefly about what's happening at the federal level and how there may be changes coming for the entire country on this subject area. And the language in this section that we're discussing today is very targeted to a few products, and it's a piecemeal approach to this, and I'm not sure why these particular subject areas were picked. There may be some very specific reasoning, and we could probably talk a lot about what we should be or shouldn't be across the board, considering how many places we find these chemicals, but is that the right approach to target those, say we just discussed ski wax? Is that the low-hanging fruit? That'd be the first part of the question, I guess. Or could you expand on what's happening federally and the timeline again, if there was any more that you might be able to add to that? Because clearly you've researched this and you've done a lot of work trying to figure out how to protect health as well as trying to figure out what's coming. And there could be more there that maybe would help the committee.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weitzman, there, to go back to the beginning again, there are over 6,000 uses of this product. And I think EPA Director Reagan had a hands-on experience with this from North Carolina, where he's from. And they had a lawsuit there, and so he's very familiar with how this works. And I think instead of trying to go through and ban 6,000 uses of it, trying to identify, okay, where's 20 areas here that we can go through where we think there's alternatives and that we can move through and help the industry get through it, whether it be grants, loans, to move them through on something that they're close on alternatives for, move them through, and it's not something that coats the engine of an airplane, you know, where it's threatening the actual, you know, public safety. Is it an MRI machine? Maybe we probably want to keep those around. So I think that the EPA, unfortunately, I don't have the 20 that they're looking at right now, but if I'm going to guess, they found 20 that they think they can get at, that there's alternatives, and working through to get those through their process, taking public comment to move through and look at those 20. And that would be a process I think that we could support rather than just pick them one by one and ban them.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. We've been discussing this issue for quite a while, not just in this committee, but in the legislature here in Minnesota for years. And I think that it's a very important conversation to have, and it's important that we're discussing it here today. The impact of the legislation, as we're hearing in testimony, could be also very potentially dangerous to, as we just heard, potentially public safety, if we're just looking at what's coming versus what's maybe in current conversation. And I hope that, and it sounds like there may be some progress, but I hope that those concerns are being heard as we're hearing testimony. For example, Mr. Chair, during the committee process, we questioned the $10,000 fines that could be potentially levied against those that unintentionally violate some of these rules. And the answer we got back was that, don't worry, that very rarely ever is applied. And I don't think that Minnesotans like that idea that at any moment they could be committing a crime without even knowing it. Yeah. I brought up the proverbial small store owner in greater Minnesota that had a product on their shelf that may contain PFAS who didn't know, didn't have a clue that could have been potentially impacted. And, you know, those are the unintended consequences that I want and I hope we can avoid. And so I'm glad we're having a very deliberate conversation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And on the Senate side, we have not had these conversations a whole lot. And that's why we're kind of indulging ourselves into finding out a little bit more. I guess, you know, unless there's any other questions, I think we should move on. But it's very... Representative Morrison.
I think Representative Wasluck was before me.
Okay. That'd be fine. Representative Wasluck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just again, want to echo the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has lobbied against PFAS legislation on the federal level. The EPA changes with the administration. So unless I have a guarantee from somebody at the EPA that they're going to do everything that they possibly can by the end of, you know, before the next presidential election, there's no guarantee that anything's going to happen because things get thrown aside when people come into a new administration that don't like what the previous EPA folks were doing. So I just, that's part of this process, right? It's like, that's why we pass state laws. Colorado just passed a whole slew of legislation similar to what we're trying to do here. So it's not like no other states are doing this, that manufacturers and people who make these products don't already have to be looking at alternatives. As Mr. Quillis said, they already are. Other states are passing this legislation. They're going to have to do that anyways. And we don't have to, wait for the feds to do something. We don't even know if they will do anything. And I just, I want to point out too that a lot of the federal legislation, at least as far as I've read, isn't about banning products. There are other pieces that they're looking at doing, but a lot of this is really focused on the environmental piece. There's some work being done on, limits on drinking water and levels and that sort of thing. But what we're really trying to do here, it's not just the environmental piece. I know this is environmental omnibus bill, but it's also a public health issue that folks are using these products. Again, we chose very specific products. We're not going after MRI machines. We're not going after engines and airplanes. And I would actually argue that those would be considered essential uses that don't have alternatives, and they probably wouldn't be involved in any sort of bans because they are important, and we know that. So just want to throw that out there again that, we've heard over and over again, let the feds do it. And the reality is that the same people fighting the ban here are fighting against PFAS legislation on the federal level. And I just find it sort of, it's not very consistent when we have folks advocating for federal changes and then the same groups of people advocating against federal changes. So I'd like to see something done. As Representative Heintzman said, I think there is some conversation to be had here on these pieces, and I'd like to move forward with something if we can do that. Thank you.
Representative Marson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to echo Representative Wasluwick that while I appreciate the enthusiasm for action at the federal level, and I agree that would be the ideal way to do it because although we have borders around our states, obviously water flows where it will flow, for example. And so the best course of action would be federal legislation. But in the meantime, as was referenced, we've been talking about this for years. And while we've been talking about it, PFAS has been continuing to accumulate in our environment. This smelt thing in Duluth, you all, is really scary. One meal a month maximum because of the amount of PFAS in those fish. So if we want to continue to eat fish that we catch from the waters of Minnesota, if we want to continue to drink the water from our beautiful state, I would just urge us to increase our sense of urgency to address these issues. And I think there are some pretty reasonable approaches in the House bill. And so I hope that we'll be able to find some common ground so that we can make some progress for the people and the environment of Minnesota.
Okay. Members, I think we're going to move on. It's very clear to me, at least I can't answer for everybody on my side or anybody in this room for that matter, that we have a lot of work to do with regards to this. It sounds like at the federal level. Being it was brought up, I guess, obviously, President Trump administration had a little different idea about this, and with the new president, they have a different idea. I'm thinking that President Trump came in and also assumed that the president before him had a different idea. So unfortunately, yes, nothing gets done, but it's in the hands of the administration that's there now, and if they're moving forward and trying to identify 20 areas of concern, I think that's something that's big. I mean, that's huge. Everybody will be watching that. Locally here, we still have the report coming back from Senator Weber, and I'd be interested to see, about landfills as well as wastewater. So with that, if you don't have any other questions, we will move on.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time. And then two things just to clarify. When we talk about action at the federal level, we're not talking about lobbying against legislation. This is agency action that Administrator Reagan has said is going to take. He doesn't need legislation to do it. He's going to do it. Yeah. And that blueprint or the roadmap that they have is said late 2022 and early 2023. And Mr. Chairman, the testifier that's going to be next is probably going to be able to give you an even more recent update on what's happening at the federal level.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Quillis. And we'll do that. We'll move to Sean Swearingen. Are you online? Okay.
Yes, Mr.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and give us your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sean Swearingen, and I am, sorry, it was technical issues. I think I'm also on video now, too.
No, you are. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Sean Swearingen is my name for the record, and I'm a director with the American Chemistry Council, director of one of the panels, the Alliance for Telechemistry Stewardship. And today my testimony is in opposition, and I'd be considered for the bill. Now, the mission of ATCF is to promote the responsible production, use, and management of fluorotelomer-based products while also advocating for sound science and a risk-based approach to regulation. As alluded to earlier in testimony yesterday and here again today, work is being done at the federal regulatory agencies, and we agree with that regulation can be done effectively and collaboratively at the federal and state levels. There is an area of concern, though, as written in the included measures of this bill, and that's surrounding the definition of PFAS, and is an overly broad and not focused on the specific applications of concern. The definition being utilized is a structural definition that European regulatory agencies like OECD classify as not appropriate for regulatory enforcement. A broad definition of PFAS would have widespread unintended consequences. As written, the definition includes hundreds, if not thousands, of different chemistries. This does not consider risk assessments, hazards, and solubility of these thousands of different chemistries either, as it contains different chemistry classes. The definition should focus on specific chemistries of concern using clear and concise language. The EPA provides that approximately 600 PFAS are manufactured, included, imported, and or used in the United States. Among these 600 are substances in solid fluoropolymers, liquids, which would be fluorotelomer-based alcohols, and gases, for example, hydrofluoric carbon refrigerant forms. The fundamental physical, chemical, and biological properties of solids, liquids, and gases are clearly different from one another, yet they are still grouped together under this definition. The legislative work being done in other states has been mentioned yesterday and today. Other states are looking at specific applications that are included in this legislation, like ski wax, juvenile products, and other consumer areas. Another state mentioned is Maine, who passed their extremely broad and overreaching essential uses concepts last year. What wasn't mentioned is that Maine is facing their own hurdles and stumbling blocks in implementing this legislation that was rushed. In Europe, they have continued to delay their own essential uses process in recognition of how a class-based approach is flawed. Finally, I'd like to speak to the alternatives process that was mentioned. While there are alternatives for some applications, not all have applicable alternatives. And in some cases, not all alternatives have been thoroughly analyzed and reviewed by agencies. The Washington State Department of Ecology is going through this exact process in their alternatives assessment and could not find applicable alternatives in performance and safety in several cases just in food packaging. They announced at the end of last year they did find suitable, safer alternatives in 4 of 10 applications. And they recently announced, I think just earlier last week, that they're delaying their second alternative assessment on the other 6 of 10 applications that did not have safer alternatives. And this goes beyond the FDA phase-out agreement that was launched in 2020. So their own timeline will be after the FDA's timeline as they go through this alternative assessment. I appreciate your consideration, and I look forward to working with the members of the committee and the bill sponsors. And we'll stay online if there's any questions.
Members, any questions with the testifier? Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Swearingen, for being here. I do have a few questions. I wanted to follow up on one that I had asked in a previous committee hearing. How much money I don't know how exactly the Chemistry Council works. I know there's members, member organizations. And so do you have any sense of how much money your organization or the member organizations have spent on cleaning up PFAS contamination?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative, Yes, I did some research on that, and I can't speak to the American Chemistry Council because we are a member trade association. So I don't think the organization itself has, but I'm sure members probably have, like 3M. They're not a member of my group specifically, but I'm sure if you looked up, some of those individual companies have.
Representative Wasowick, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm hearing this different conversation about classes of chemicals. Can you tell me, I'm just wondering if you can tell me which PFAS chemicals are safe and which ones are not safe, according to research that's been done on the health impacts.
Mr. Swearingen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I'll look at, I'll just use fluoropolymers, for example, and I know you mentioned these and other members have. Those are considered a PFAS in this broad definition, but these fluoropolymers are highly stable. They don't leach. They don't leach with the human contact interaction. These are a type of PFAS that's been used in your medical devices and your stents, for instance. And then take a look at fluorotelomers, which is part of the panel that I manage. That is used in textiles for personal protection equipment, but also chiefly looking at the medical field. So these are your medical gowns, your medical drapes. They're used to protect our first responders and those in the healthcare field from biological hazards, which would be deemed safe.
Representative, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I didn't hear an answer to the question. My question was which of these are safe? According to, all the testing that's supposedly been done to show that they're safe, that's what I'm concerned about. And that's why, that lack of knowledge about, what's safe and what's not safe is concerning to me. And I think there is research being done, right, with the EPA and other organizations, agencies, states doing this research. But I think that's a thing that is concerning, is that we're going to say we don't really know what's safe and not safe. But we're going to continue to use them, and we're going to oppose anyone that tries to say we don't want to use them, because the research that we do have that's been done by scientific organizations does show human health impacts, negative health impacts. So just sort of want to point that out, that we are using probably millions of chemicals that we haven't actually tested, that the people who make them haven't tested to show us that they're safe, and we're finding out more and more information as time goes by that these chemicals aren't safe. And I think it's important that we take steps to address the PFAS contamination, not only for the human health effects, but for the fact that this is extremely, they're forever chemicals, they don't go away, and we have to end up paying for the cleanup costs from these companies that make these chemicals and that don't want to, don't seem supportive of regulations and sort of don't seem supportive of wanting to help clean up with the cleanup costs, even though they are the organizations that have made these chemicals and have put us in this place where we are now with this widespread contamination. So that's all, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Morrison. I'm sorry, Mr. Swearingen, would you like to respond?
If I could, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and thank you for your follow-up, Representative. And maybe I'll just dive a little bit deeper. These products do have to be thoroughly vetted and researched, one, by the individual manufacturers before they come to market, but then also by the regulatory agency that end up clearing them. So, if you're looking at food contacts and other representative or other agencies, administrations were mentioned, the FDA, even though they vetted the food contact of PFAS in food packaging, they still went back and agreed to the phase-out timeline that was done under the Trump administration. And then now looking at other applications that's being done by the Biden administration. So whether it ebbs and flows, PFAS has still been a concern by these regulatory agencies over time. So the bottom line is all these chemistries have to be thoroughly vetted and reviewed before they go to market. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I can just follow up with one question.
Yeah, quick follow-up. Thank you.
What does that review process look like? Does that involve animal studies? Is there a human health impact studies? What does that process look like?
Mr. Swearingen, if you can answer that.
Is it long-term?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. Great question. Happy to dive in a little bit further. I know there's different levels within different applications, whether it's animal studies, human health studies, long-term studies. Happy to talk to colleges and bring them and have them involved as well for further information. But that's a great question.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here, Mr. Swearingen. I'm wondering if you have access to information about how many lobbyists the council employs and how much money the council invests in working to prevent regulation of PFAS or bans. And I'm curious if Mr. Quillis if he's still here, if he's able to comment on the amount of money the chamber invests in these efforts as well.
Mr. Swearingen, I'm not sure if the question is appropriate here, but if you want to give that a try, why, I'm sure you have somewhat of an idea, I guess, for an answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I really can't say off the top of my head, but if we're allowed to certainly take a look at that. And I would amend that to say, you know, we're not trying to. My personal stake is not to try and stop any legislation, but try to work together with parties on both sides of the aisle. As I mentioned, you know, we're looking to work cooperatively, as I mentioned, at all levels of regulation and legislation.
Representative, I think this kind of questioning is really not getting to the point of what the bill has got forward here, brought forward. We could go back and forth as to environmental interests and how much money they invest in things that the industry probably doesn't agree with, back and forth. I just see this as a waste of time. So,
Mr. Quillis,
if you want to answer that, go ahead. Otherwise, I think we need to move on.
Mr. Chairman, no problem. The campaign Public Finance Board requires us to report what we spend every year on lobbying, and it's public record.
Sure. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really not trying to be inappropriate. I just think it's an important piece of the conversation for the public. I think it's important information for the public to understand as we have these conversations. So thank you for your answers,
sure.
Gentlemen.
And the public needs to know as well that there's another side of the coin that also either supports or pushes for legislation on the environmental side as well. And I don't think that I would even bother to ask how much money that is, because quite frankly, I think some of that is probably covered under the First Amendment, and I don't really care. We want to get to the bottom of it no matter what here. So. With that, members, I think we're going to move on. Thank you very much for the testifiers so far.
I'm
sorry. Rick, Representative Hansen had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I had a question for Mr. Swearingen. Were you on during Mr. Quillis's presentation?
Mr. Swearingen.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I was.
Okay. So you heard my line of questioning relating to ski wax you know, do you have the same concerns where the issues are the laddering of a phase out with the wholesaler and the retailer, where that is one type of correction to legislation that would be supportive, as well as the intentionally added provision? Are you in alignment with kind of those two concerns that were referenced with Mr. Quillis?
Mr. Swearingen.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. Yeah, we're in line with those concerns. I tried to kind of keep it very large at the PFAS definition. It applied, you know, across the line of different sections of the bill. Intentionally added, we've seen is language has been added to a lot of other state legislation pieces. And, you know, we'd be, you know, in favor of that type of language. Being added here, I think it was also included in Maine's essential uses bill. And another state mentioned before was Colorado, and I think we worked with getting that similar language established there as well.
And Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
And so, you know, I understand and heard with interest the essential uses. So I want to be clear, we're not talking about airplane engines. We're not talking about medical devices. One of the things we're talking about is ski wax, which doesn't seem to be an essential use. You know, there was wax before PFAS ski wax. And, you know, even on the cosmetic side, mascara around the eyes, you know, not all cosmetics, but what about what we put in our eye, around our eyes? Wouldn't we want to, you know, maybe something that has, because the eyes are very absorbent for chemistry. You know, I would say again, we would be willing to have discussions on those type of things where we can at least make some progress where we're not putting PFAS into the environment. And they may be small. I'm not talking, again, about airplane engines. I'm talking about ski wax. And is there some place where we can find common ground there? I would ask if that's possible.
Mr. Swearengin?
Mr. Chair. Yeah. No, I completely agree, Representative. I, you know, those would not be essential uses, and I think there would probably be some work there to be done. And, you know, just to use an example going back to definition, is that type of chemistry, if it is used in those applications, would be completely different than the type of PFAS that's utilized in airplane engines and cell phones and electric car batteries and the like. So I think there could be some work done there, yes.
Thank you. I guess I have a question, and I do see somebody here with regards to wastewater treatment. If PFAS were to continue the prohibition of PFAS in which obviously ends up in the wastewater, have we got any numbers at all that we know of what wastewater treatment facilities would be up against and how what the costs would be? Maybe we could get PCA to come up as well, maybe. Welcome to the committee. I know this has been a concern, and I'm wondering if you can shed a little light on the...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Conference Committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and if I understood the question correctly, wastewater treatment facilities have had a tremendous concern about PFAS compounds, both because of their potential impacts on the waters, that the receiving waters and the public health, but also because we hold permits that could end up being required to find ways to manage these chemicals. And right now, there is no identified technology that can remove these compounds from wastewater or stormwater because of the other organics and things that are found in those water flows. So while we have some ways we can treat drinking water that are very expensive and get a number of PFAS compounds out, the cost is kind of unknown at this point because we don't have a technology to remove it at wastewater plants right now.
Okay. Mr. Kudelka, do you have any concerns or have you done any studies on what potentially could wastewater treatment facilities have to put forward to in order to take all PFAS out of the water system?
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, Kirk Kudelka, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the question. We do not have any estimates, and like the League of Minnesota Cities testified, it's why it's so important that we really look upstream and source reduction to make sure that they don't have to deal with it.
Okay. So, Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudelka, how about estimates as to how to fully remove PFAS from leachate?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there are a few pilot projects that are being worked on right now. I don't have those numbers right now in front of me. Counties like St. Louis County are looking at various methods, and including seeking funding from the legislature to help with those pilot projects.
Follow up. I'm sorry, I'm not hearing the question.
I'll speak up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudelka, how about what is MPCA looking at specifically relative to leaching and removal of PFAS?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the question. We are working with entities and their projects moving forward for pilots to remove it from leachate. But a lot of our focus is looking upstream, identifying sources, reducing sources, so we don't have to do the treatment at leachate pieces. For instance, we use legislative money to help with a source study on PFAS going to compost facilities and identify things like food packaging as a large source to that area. So identifying areas where PFAS is coming into these systems and then working with parties to remove it from that waste stream.
Follow up.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So the reason, Mr. Kadalka, that I'm asking is, of course, because these things are going to be persistent in landfills for a long time. And while MPCA may be focused on upstream sources at the moment, it seems prudent that we would be looking at how we deal with issues relative to leachate and landfills. And so I hope that's also a part of your focus, is a broad approach to this. And I've talked to you about this before in previous conversations, and I'm going to continue to bring it up because I think it's critical, and I think Minnesotans expect us, certainly expect MPCA as an agency, to be working on that very specifically. We can look upstream for another 100 years. I think all of us know that we're going to have to be also focused on PFAS as it already exists in landscape and in, for example, landfills.
Mr. Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I appreciate that. And MPCA has supported efforts for funding through LCCMR for this type of work. And the governor's budget includes $2 million for community grants. And one of the areas we'd like to target is specifically those pilot projects, those who are looking to move ahead and test technologies in that. That would be one of the possible uses. So the MPCA agrees with you. We do believe there should be monetary support, and it is in the governor's budget for $2 million for the PFAS community grants.
Okay. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think this discussion actually proves the point on the prior discussion, that prevention is better than cleanup. So as long as every day, every hour, we keep adding PFAS to the environment, it shows up in landfills and wastewater eventually, and we can't get it out. So the only way to deal with it is to prevent it from going in. And I'm hopeful after this discussion today that we could at least make progress on non-essential PFAS in ski wax. We do one little thing to say we're not going to do more PFAS in the environment. Because when you're using it on the trail, it goes into the snow, goes from the snow into the water, gets into the water, goes to Lake Superior, gets in the smelt, gets in the landfill. Thousands of chemicals ending up in the environment, and then the public has to pay for the cleanup costs, whether it's the city or the state, and it's almost impossible. But we keep adding this stuff day in, day out, every hour, every minute into our environment, and it accumulates forever.
Okay, thank you. Members, next on the agenda, we have some certain concerns from our members with regards to the treated seed and pesticides. I do have somebody from here, from the CropLife American Responsibility Industry for a Sound Environment, Darren McBeth. Welcome to the committee. Members, we're talking here, I think, mainly about seed and pesticides, which is generally an agricultural issue. So I'm first of all, let me start out by asking the chairman, possibly Representative Hanson, as to why this is not in the Ag Committee. Maybe it is. Maybe I don't know that. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the pesticide control law, Minnesota Statute 18B, relates to the use of pesticides. And the use of a pesticide for seed treatment, the moment of application, is when the pesticide is applied to the seed. Then that application is done. So the pesticide control law ends at that point. The seed law is responsible for the distribution and use of the seed. So when the seed is no longer used or no longer can be used, it becomes solid waste. and solid waste is in the jurisdiction of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Now, for a year, the agencies couldn't figure it out. So that is why we've got the description in here for the rulemaking to clarify it so that the rules provide clarity for the regulated clientele in terms of who's responsible, what, and when. So there are provisions in the Ag Committee on the Ag portion, but the disposal portions of treated seed that is no longer going to be used is the waste. Where does it go? Landfill? Incinerator? Or Nebraska to an ethanol plant be burned? That's why it's in our jurisdiction.
All right. That's fair. Mr. McBeth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darren McBeth, representing CropLife America and RISE, Responsible Industry for a Sustainable Environment. And I've also consulted with the American Seed Trade Association, or ASTA, in my comments today. And I'm happy to provide some background to the committee. I don't disagree with Representative Hansen's assessment of environment, natural resources, jurisdiction, and relevant laws and oversight by the Pollution Control Agency. I'm going to talk about the DNR, but also the Department of Agriculture and these, what's predominantly an agriculture technology tool that I want to edify this committee a little bit. I do have some concerns with the House provisions, and I'll share those with the committee as well. Let me start with going back to basics a little bit on, just to elaborate on Chair Hansen's comments with seed treatments. What are they? What's their role? Why are they important? And why are we concerned with some of the recommendations in this package? And then I'll talk about neonicotinoids, which is a chemical product, insecticide that's also implicated, just in way of background before I get into the specific four or five provisions in the House package. So seed treatments are an important tool that provide farmers with an economical means of protecting seeds and seedlings against early season insect pests and diseases. Seed treatment technology provides several advantages to farmers as part of their integrated pest management programs. Seed treatments reduce potential risks to the environment and applicators by placing microscopic amounts of pesticide on the seed coating rather than having to apply a foliar type application over top of the field with a sprayer. The seed treatments are highly regulated, just as foliar and soil applied pesticides are. Seed treatment products undergo a thorough evaluation by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and by applicable state agencies prior to commercialization. Specifically, the federal insecticide pesticide law, FIFRA, Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, allows products that are treated with registered and approved pesticides to continue to be considered as what's called a treated article. Some refer to this as the treated article exemption, a misnomer, because despite what you may have heard, it's not an exemption from regulation. All pesticide-treated seeds are registered as a treated article if three conditions are met. The article contains or is treated with a registered pesticide. The pesticide is intended to protect the article itself, the seed, and the pesticide is registered for that use of that pest control. So it's a very important tool, highly regulated, and very prevalent among farmers in planting. In this state, mostly corn and soybeans and other crops. Now, let me just shift a little background on one chemistry that's implicated throughout many of the House provisions, and those are neonicotinoids, or for short, neonics, because we all stumble on saying neonicotinoids repeatedly. Neonics represent one of the most significant advances in insecticide technology in recent history and are among the safest pesticides for people and the environment. Initially registered even as reduced risk, which is a key status that the Environmental Protection Agency deploys under FIFRA, neonics are also an important crop protection technology, sometimes in many cases applied to seeds, and they're a vital agriculture tool that provide protection to a variety of crops and do so in a more efficient, better way for the environment than spray. So now let me turn to, I've consolidated a few of the issues in the House bill. I've consolidated it down into four issues, but I'll point out in the committee staff's environment and natural resources policy provisions of Senate only, House only, you know, it's all the provisions on page three, from Article 3. So first, and there's some letters that have been handed in from True Green, from the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers Association, that I'll elaborate a little bit on this, but the preemption exception for cities to regulate pesticides is at R54. The word preemption, pesticide regulation is reserved for the federal government, the EPA, and in Minnesota, the Department of Agriculture. They're the experts, they have the expertise, they oversee registrations. Just like in, I think, about 43 other states, pesticide regulation is reserved or preempted from being regulated and banned at a local level, and it's reserved in Minnesota for the Department of Agriculture. And to deviate from that, it's a big deal. It becomes a patchwork of different regulations of non-experts that, when human and environmental safety and health are at issue, we want it to be done right, and we want it to be done by experts. There's also the economic or commerce concerns about a patchwork of different localities getting into the business of a complicated, important subject of pesticide regulation, and to ban it or require different uses or restrictions in 800 some cities becomes a problem. The provisions starting at R54 perpetuate another misnomer called pollinator lethal insecticides, that definition, when in reality, yes, pesticides are dangerous or lethal to the targeted insect, but they're not dangerous to non-targets if used according to the label, and that's what the EPA and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture Pesticide and Fertilizer Division enforce and register. This section at R54 in allowing cities to pass an ordinance or to violate the preemption doctrine, it has some carve-outs or some exceptions for lice, bed bugs, mosquito control products only if used by the Metro Mosquito Control District. But that's one list. Emerald ash borer control could be implicated here, is not mentioned. It's just concerning to go down this road of enumerating certain uses that are allowed, but leaving open the others that could be banned. When that is regulated now by the Department of Agriculture with safety and expertise at play. Moving on to the second area in the House bill I can shed some light on is the at R56, Section 8, the ban on neonicotinoids and chlorpyrifos on wildlife management areas or DNR managed lands. I know this was discussed a little bit yesterday by the committee and Assistant Commissioner Meyer. As Commissioner Meyer yesterday pointed out, and I think the committee knows, the ban or the disallowance of neonicotinoids on state lands is a choice and a prerogative that the agency currently has in place now. And we don't agree with it. We think it leads to potentially, you know, poorer food plots and management of natural resources and habitat, but it's in place now. There's no need to put it in state law, and frankly, it's an effort to name this vilified chemistry that is actually safe and helpful and efficient, neonicotinoids, in state law as something that's banned, and we disagree with it. Lastly, on this area of banning this class of pesticides, neonicotinoids on state lands, essentially, it was referenced yesterday with it's important to the certification of forestry lands in the state, and I do agree the Forestry Sustainability Council, FSC, is an important certification that wood and paper products want to maintain for different reasons. That particular certification and quasi-agency FSC is managed out of Bonn, Germany, and they have reams of requirements and protocols that go into what one needs to do in order to have that certification. It's a red herring that using neonics on a food plot in Martin County of a WMA that's managed for pheasants and upland game or hunting versus a forested area like in Lake of the Woods or a WMA area that the DNR may be partnering on or managing. It's just apples and oranges and a statewide ban to say it's to maintain the DNR's ability to have FSC or the Forestry Steward Sustainability Council's certification is a bridge too far. Thirdly, out of four kind of specific areas in the House package, I'm going to talk about the prohibition on neonicotinoid-treated seeds for use as food, feed, oil, or ethanol feedstock. And this is at R55, sections 4 and 5. And I'm going to bundle in here the additional prohibition in the House package on disposal methods of treated seeds. So there's a kind of a their use and then their disposal. And the other disposal parts are at R83, section 52. So these uses of treated seed, food, feed, oil. So Representative Hansen was correct that it's a chemical, neonicotinoid, applied on, and many other chemistries are applied as a seed treatment, and it's a chemical. You don't want to eat it. And that's already labeled as such, as a precautionary statement, on bags of seed. And I have an image of what the label looks like. I didn't make copies. I'd be glad to hand it around. But that is regulated, and it falls under the jurisdiction of the Food and Drug Administration. And further use of, and so that's getting kind of at a treated seed as opposed to the resulting progeny of the corn crop or the soybean crop that then go into vegetable oil or a food use. The treated seed portion that one plants is regulated. It could be hazardous to consume, and that's why there's a precautionary label on every bag that's sold, and that's why one would need a permit to use it for a food use, which would be ridiculous, and that's governed by the Food and Drug Administration, the Food Quality Protection Act. Then on the environmental side, Clean Water Act. If used in an ethanol plant as or an incinerator type disposal or use, Clean Air Act would be implicated, and the Pollution Control Agency would need to issue a permit for those types of uses. So lastly on this area, the House language at R83, line 60.19, prohibits the disposal of treated seed by burying near water, composting, or by incinerating within a home or other dwelling, all addressed in the precautionary label that already is on bags of treated seed. And incinerating in a home or dwelling, I mean, that doesn't happen. It's a solution looking for a problem. And as hazardous as that would be, at some point, I think the precautionary labels that already exist and regulations and federal regulations that already exist and common sense should really prevail. Lastly, the requirement for Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to start to regulate disposal and use of treated agriculture seeds is in the House provisions at R56, Section 6. And then to conduct rulemaking on those subjects at R102, Section 89. part of the language requires the Pollution Control Agency to develop guidance for disposal of treated seed, and again, they've already done so. And they have the authority to develop that guidance. Representative Hansen was advocating for it, I believe, last year or maybe previously, and it's finished. The Pollution Control Agency issued it, and they did a good job. The language at 26.29 on R56 further then actually directs the Pollution Control Agency, among other things, to develop and maintain guidance regarding the use of treated seed with neonic pesticides. And this is back, Mr. Chairman, to your initial question, I think, about jurisdiction and about an agriculture topic and a seed use, to direct the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, while its disposal and guidance on its disposal, if it's not used or planted, Representative Hansen has a point, and I think that's been addressed, but to direct, for the legislature to direct the Pollution Control Agency to deal with the use of the seed is an agriculture function. And so we disagree with that choice of words. And lastly, also as part of the rulemaking directive in the House package, it's one thing for the legislature to direct the rulemaking itself be conducted on any subject, but to direct an agency to, within its rulemaking, clearly identify, is the language that's used in the bill, its own regulatory jurisdiction. So directing rulemaking and an agency to clearly identify its regulatory jurisdiction, when that is the role of this committee and of the legislature. So I'm going to conclude there, and I apologize for the deep dive into some of the technology tools that are important to agriculture. This has been discussed in the House Agriculture Committee this year. But it's also been discussed in the House Environment and Natural Resources Committee and is in the House Environment and Natural Resources Committee omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. McBeth. It brings back when we started talking about protection of bees. Oh, goodness, it's been probably 4 or 5 years ago. I have one of the largest companies, and I think in one of the largest in the state, in Otter Tail County, and I called them and I asked what kind of legislation would you like to see, and because at that time I think we were talking about sprayovers, crop sprayovers and whatnot, and he said, we don't need anything, all you got to do is read the label. He says, we're not asking for anything, just read the label, and if you read the label, everything is going to be fine, it's covered. So when you start talking about labels like that, it just brought back that story to me. And at that particular time, it certainly, like right now, makes sense. That's what all those little fine prints, sometimes you even have to open them up, and they get to be about this long on something you buy at Fleet Farm to apply to on weeds. I mean, and of course, we all read that, right? But nevertheless, it's in general, we're supposed to follow the guidelines that's already, all the work that's been done. So I thank you for your testimony here. And again, I question whether we should be dealing with this particular area in our committee. But if Representative Hansen talks about getting rid of it and landfilling it or putting it wherever it goes, can you elaborate a little bit more on what you think about those kind of comments? Being incinerated or disposal of
yeah, thank you, Mr.
seed.
Chairman. So when seed, when treated seed is unused for any number of reasons, typically it's rebated back to the seed company, and it's valuable stuff. And if it hasn't germinated and can be reused, the farmer may save it, but if it's unusable, it's typically rebated back to the company, but some may, a certain volume, which is unknown, may accumulate, and what is done with it. And one thing that Representative Hansen and others have brought up that was in the news now a couple of years ago, one source of treated seed was going into, it would have been corn seed, likely going into the manufacture of ethanol at a plant in Meade, Nebraska. And it, unbeknownst to many people, was an outlet for treated seed. And then one of the byproducts of ethanol are dried distillers' grains, as opposed to the alcohol, the liquid portion of the ethanol manufacturing process. And against state law, let me back up. Meade, Nebraska had permits to take in and manufacture, of course, ethanol, and there are other state and federal laws about safety and quality of feed that is a byproduct of ethanol or dried distillers' grains. And they left a certain portion of some of the byproduct uncovered, and there was a chemical nature or component to it that was originated with the seed treatment, and it leached in the ground. It was a very porous, I don't know what kind of soils in that area, but it's known for having groundwater problems, and they're in violation of the law, and they've been prosecuted by the Attorney General, and I think maybe there's been some federal criminal action against that one company. And light bulbs went off all over among environmental activists and those who wanted to villainize seed treatments and neonicotinoids that something needed to be done about it, when it was one instance of an illegal act that has now been prosecuted. And to your other question, Mr. Chairman, other licensed or regulated uses may include incineration. And once again, emissions controls, regulations from the Clean Air Act to state regulations that in Minnesota the Pollution Control Agency would deploy. And by the way, any ethanol plant that wanted to utilize treated seed in its manufacture process would again need a permit from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So that is an outlet for unused treated seed, but it's regulated and or not used in Minnesota. Landfills, it would be a toxic substance or toxic in terms of a chemical substance, and to just take it in and bury it, similar to other chemical substances, the landfill would need, I'm not familiar with that area of permits and laws that would apply for them to do so.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe the League of Cities is able to provide testimony on the preemption provision, if we could have
sure.
Testimony.
If you'd like to stay there for other questions, and appreciate that. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities. And the League did mention in the letter we provided to the committee that we support the House language that's found on R54 and 55 that deals with city ordinances related to pesticide use. Just to be clear, we are not asking that cities have the authority to declare pesticides to be pollinator lethal and eliminate them based on their judgment. This statute says Department of Ag would determine which chemicals are on that list, and it's an on or off. A city either can choose to restrict those or not. That's all they can choose. They can't choose to decide which ones to restrict or to what level to restrict. It's just one or the other. And that's the authority that a number of our cities have requested, because as you know, many communities are very worried about pollinator effects of the use of chemicals within their city's jurisdiction. Many are not and do not want to have to enforce this law right now, which is why it's presented as an option. A city can choose to have an ordinance that does this.
Describe me the application, would you, for a city?
I'm
Describe
sorry?
The application for a city.
For a city? A yeah. city in this
case. A city
case,
that wants this, yeah.
A city in this case would need to pass an ordinance that restricts the chemical and links to the list provided by the Department of Agriculture.
Department of Ag.
Yep.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Johnson, let's say the city of West St. Paul wanted to do this. They would contact the Department of Agriculture, work with them. They'd have to have the public hearings, the notice of publication, probably have to go through the Planning Commission and then have a public meeting and pass it. And, you know, people can come in the office and in the room and testify. And then there would also be the oversight of the Department of Agriculture on the labels, et cetera. Is that correct?
So, Mr. Chair and members, I would expect if this law were to change, the League and the Department of Agriculture would work together to put together information for cities that were interested, so model ordinances, things of that nature. And then the normal city decision-making process would have to occur for an ordinance to be brought in front of the council and voted on, which includes, you know, two separate hearings, at least 30 days notice of each one, plus public testimony options. But one thing that would not be an option is varying from the list the Department of Agriculture gives.
Okay. Thank you, members. Any questions of the two testifiers? We have one more. Mr. Murray, Patrick Murray from the Executive Director of Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. Sorry it took so long to get you there.
No worries, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
So, Mr. Chairman, members of the conference committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Patrick Murray. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. We're a statewide trade association. We represent ag retailers, distributors, crop input suppliers, crop advisors, and registrants who manufacture crop inputs for farmers throughout Minnesota. And so I'm going to kind of reinforce some of the things Mr. McBeth mentioned and some of the provisions included in the House bill. And I'll just kind of go down the list and state where the provision is located and some of the language that might be a little duplicative of what Mr. McBeth said, but I think it should be heard again for committee members and for the public. So the first provision MCPR opposes is Article 2 of the House bill, which is included in Section 2 and 3, dealing with the authority of the cities to be allowed to prohibit the use of certain pesticides within their borders if adopted by a city ordinance, which we just had the question about. I would say that MCPR poses that language as it would eliminate the existing state authority that ensures safe and consistent regulatory standards for pesticide use in the state. The language would weaken the state's ability to effectively regulate pesticides that are registered and regulated by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. The current regulations enforced by MDA ensure safe and proper pesticide use in the state through registration of pesticides, licensing of pesticide applicators, and through research and enforcement activities. Uniform state law comprehensively regulates virtually every other aspect of labeling, distribution, sale, storage, transportation, use and application, and disposal of pesticides in the state. State regulation of pesticides also ensures uniformity with federal regulation and between states and their municipalities to avoid confusion that may endanger public health or the environment from differing requirements. In addition, I would add also that this provision would make it more difficult for farmers to produce the food that we all depend on. This legislation would also put our communities at risk, leading to more disease caused by more pests roaming around our homes, schools, daycare centers, hospitals, public transportation, and restaurants throughout the state. Pesticides play an important role in agriculture, including the Integrated Pest Management Plan, which Mr. Beth also mentioned. Crop protection tools and technologies are vital to protect farmers' crops and enable farmers to grow more food using less land and resources, protecting farmers' investments and making food more affordable. The next provision I'd like to state on the record here that MCPR opposes is it also located in Article 2 of the House bill. It's included in Section 5, and this would prohibit the use and sale of seeds treated with neonicotinoids. So treated seeds undergo a thorough evaluation by the U.S. EPA and applicable state agencies prior to commercialization and periodically thereafter. Only after a product is approved by the relevant federal and state agencies can the seed treatment product be used in accordance with the EPA-approved label. Labels for commercial seed treatment products carry language that must be placed on the seed tags accompanying treated seed packages regarding permitted and prohibited practices. If enacted, this provision would deny Minnesota's farmers existing products that have gone through this science-based registration process implemented by the EPA and MDA under the provisions of FIFRA, the Food Quality Protection Act, and the State of Minnesota Seed Law. And then the next provision I'd also like to state our opposition to is also located in Article 2 of the House Bill, Section 6 and 52, which would require MDA to develop and maintain consumer guidance regarding the proper use and disposal of neonicotinoid-treated seed. The Minnesota Crop Production Retailers, we believe that the language is unnecessary as the existing layers of federal and state regulations are sufficient and protective. Disposal of treated seed is critical to the full life cycle stewardship and is recognized by the industry as a main priority. In fact, MCPR's mission statement is that our organization exists to promote the proper use, storage, and application of crop production inputs in an environmentally and agronomically sound manner. Further regulation through the creation of this guidance, we feel, is unwarranted and, again, duplicative. Additionally, I would also like to add, without the direction of from the legislator, the MPCA, as Mr. Macbeth mentioned earlier, did recently publish guidance on treated seed disposal. We feel this action not only raises questions about the MPCA's authority to publish this guidance, but also renders these provisions directing and appropriating funds for consumer guidance to the Department of Agriculture within the Environment Bill unnecessary. The guidance from MPCA also states that treated seed should not be used for ethanol production, and it's my understanding that no ethanol plant here in the state of Minnesota is permitted by MPCA to burn treated seed, and it's highly unlikely that MPCA would ever authorize such a permit to be granted. The MPCA guidance appears to already exist, already address the language that's included in Article 2, Section 6 and 52 of the House Bill, seemingly making the provision unnecessary. So in closing, Mr. Chairman, MPCR, I appreciate the opportunity to comment on the legislation, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Murray, I listened closely, particularly in light of Mr. Johnson's testimony. Are you saying that the cities are not competent when you said that this would jeopardize public health, that the cities are not competent to do this?
Mr. Murray.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, I did not say that. I simply stated the fact that there's federal law that supersedes, state law that supersedes the regulation of these laws.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Well, and we can change the law, and that's what we're proposing to do here, is to allow the cities, working with the Department of Agriculture, that would provide that umbrella. Could you tell me how, if the city of West St. Paul passed an ordinance, how that would hurt farmers? How would that hurt farmers?
Mr. Murray.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, again, I would go back to, this is already covered by the state law. Again, it would create a patchwork quilt. I'm not castigating or pointing out to any particular city in the state, but we think that this is already covered by state law.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Murray, you said that it would jeopardize public health and it would hurt agriculture if cities had this authority. You just said that. I'd like to know how. How would it jeopardize public health if the city of West St. Paul passed an ordinance working with the Department of Agriculture? How would that hurt agriculture?
Mr. Murray, and then we'll...
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, again, it would be the patchwork quilt. We think the cities, cities are already strapped for resources, so to add this additional regulation for somebody at the city to have to go through this process could potentially, be the camel's nose under the tent.
So,
always.
We're going to get into this argument here. I mean, back and forth is not going to do us any good here, but it's very clear to me that the ag community has, years and years ago done their work along with the industry to come up with ways of producing crops and producing some big yields of crops, quite frankly, to feed us all. they're feeding not only our nation but other nations as well, and it behooves them, I think, to do things properly, especially in light of the Environmental Protection Agency overseeing these products. And the question of landfill burning of treated seed, apparently that's been handled. According to the other testifier, that was Kansas area?
Maybe. Mr. Chair, the Mead, Nebraska.
Nebraska.
Anyone could Google Mead, Nebraska, and the contamination is still there.
No.
the site is still contaminated even though the laws were broken because they can't clean it up.
Sure.
Piles of DDGs that are contaminated, air quality, water quality, people's homes.
But we wouldn't, it doesn't seem to me that we would jeopardize the whole industry over one bad actor. It sounds like justice prevailed, along with a pretty hefty fine and I'm sure cleanup costs. And as the testifier also said, you'd have to get a huge permit to, you know, from the PCA to even do such a thing in Minnesota, and there hasn't been one in Minnesota. So I guess, yeah, if we want to stop everything from happening before it happens, we could be here an awful long time. But nevertheless, you have a bad actor once in a while. It was taken care of, and it sounds to me like that's something that we don't really need to be talking about.
Someone's on the clock.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Kelly, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two comments and one question. It seems like the last two testifiers leave us with the impression that there is zero risk in using these pesticides. And I just want to make sure that that's not what the testimony is, because we know that that is not true. And I would appreciate a comment from either or both. And then I feel, partly in response to Representative Hansen's line of questioning, so are you saying that you prefer to mandate pesticide use in cities? Because it seems to me that if cities aren't allowed to make their own rules about use within their city, that that's sort of a mandate imposed on cities to use those pesticides.
Representative Hansen, would you like to answer that?
I think that was directed to the testifiers.
Mr. Murray, or...
Yes, Mr. Chair, do you mind repeating that question again, Representative?
Yeah, it was kind of a two-part question, Representative. Would you repeat it again? I thought it was directed at Representative Hansen, but go ahead, try it again.
Sure, Mr. Chair. My first question was, it seemed to me that both testifiers were implying that these pesticides are entirely safe, that they are without risk. And I wanted to make sure that, of course, we know that's not true, and I just wanted to make sure that was clarified. And then the second question was about mandating pesticide use in cities, because it strikes me that if your testimony is that you are against allowing cities to make their own rules around pesticide use, that you're actually mandating pesticide use on the cities. So those are my two questions for one for the second testifier, and then the first to both, if they're able to comment.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
And committee members, the registration process for a pesticide is lengthy and rigorous, and there's a lot of oversight from a lot of experts, starting with the Environmental Protection Agency, and then other agencies, in terms of, yes, pesticides carry a risk, and that's why they are regulated, and that's why they're tested, and that's why they're approved for very focused things, and the way they're used, and any residue has oversight over it from, on the food side, the Food and Drug Administration, and on the environmental side, the Environmental Protection Agency and others. And I don't think Mr. Murray or myself meant to leave any impression that there's not a reason for their regulation, and that is there are risks. But when one follows the label, and labels are created with those risks in mind to have parameters to their use, just like many things in our society, and pesticides are a necessary tool or an aid to being able to eat, to growing crops that feed livestock and feed humans without pests. To the other question as to a mandate on cities to use pesticides, I think I can speak for Mr. Murray and myself. He's free to speak too. No one is suggesting there's a mandate on cities to use pesticides. This is a question of local control. That's what preemption preempts. The lack of uniformity and non-experts making decisions, or cities in this case being approached by activists with half the information, with an agenda on banning this pesticide or that pesticide, when all these pest control products, whether they're for agriculture, commercial, or residential uses, are registered and have labels, and those labels need to be followed. And when they are followed, they're safe. And they are safe to the humans, and they're safe to the environment, and they're safe to non-target species when their labels are followed. And that's why they're regulated. And to, it's a complex subject, and to throw out, to throw the ability out to 840-some cities in the state of Minnesota to assert their so-called expertise or pressures from a proposed ordinance to regulate them or ban them, that's a case where when local control can mean many things and have many roles, where local people, governance should and could apply, that's not one where we think it should apply.
So I think the question has been answered. If you follow the label with these highly tested, highly approved substances, they are safe. If you deviate otherwise, they can be dangerous. And I think that's what they said. Mr. Murray, would you like to finish anything up with that question at all?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the representative's questions about the risk, you know, what I would say is for our membership, which are ag retailers all located throughout the state in many different communities, they have large teams of folks that take a lot of training to become applicators or certified crop advisors in that field of work. And what we do is we put on several sessions throughout the year in conjunction with the University of Minnesota Extension, where we bring those folks in to get their CEU credit so they can continue to work in this field. So yes, there is risk involved, but our members are trained very well so that they are making the right decisions when they are making applications. So I would just close with that piece. From the no risk piece, I can't speak for other organizations or entities that may apply on a residential side. That's not my membership, but I'm speaking from the agricultural retailer's perspective, Mr. Chairman.
And I would assume also that if those guidelines aren't followed, there's always a risk of danger as well as litigation. I mean, it's just that's why we have training for many different aspects of applications of all kinds of products. And it just seems to be work real well, unless it's abused. And again, one abuser or one person that makes that mistake doesn't mean we should change the whole world for that. And Mr. Lippert, you had a question. Okay, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just on this point, and I don't know if Mr. Murray knows that, but I did the certification program. It's not enough. Not enough. You can do all the training you want, but errors occur. And one of the things with training is to have clarity, and the clarity that goes beyond what we're talking about here. And I listened very closely to what you were saying, and it sounded like you were opposing the PCA actually providing an educational brochure. It was unclear because first it was we oppose this, and then they've already created it, so then they don't need to do it. It took a year for them to do that. And I know that the Department of Ag tried to meet with the PCA and the ag lobbies last year to meet on, and they freaked out. Called everybody, said, oh my gosh, they're doing something on seed treatment. This is after we're not meeting. It took a lot of work to do that. So where did the language originally come from on the disposal? It came from the University of Minnesota publication 5 years ago, saying don't bury treated seed next to a river. Don't burn it. And one of the things we do with training is you tell people the obvious, because not everybody knows the obvious. And you keep repeating it. And you try different methods of education. And so I hope you weren't saying we can't have a brochure or that we shouldn't update it as we get more information. Because we have been getting more information, and particularly on neonicotinoids. every year, every month publications, some of the funding that we've provided that shows the treatment of seed, the application, again, under FIFRA, is to that seed. The seed gets planted. During the planting of the seeds rub against each other. You used to put talc in the seed because corn is not a circular thing. It rubs against each other. Goes up in the air. Goes up in the air when the corn's being planted. Those microscopic parts of neonicotinoids come in contact. Where do they fall? They fall on dandelions. They fall on flowers. They fall on the pollen. The bees come in contact, not just the bees, but the butterflies, the birds, come in contact with that neonicotinoid. Not just honeybees, but native bees, where maybe if you kill the queen of the bumblebee, then you have no baby bumblebees because you killed the queen. And little bits of neonicotinoid that we can't see are in the air. Published peer-reviewed paper after paper after paper after paper. Published peer-reviewed paper saying that application to soybean seed does not have a yield beneficial effect. Three land-grant institutions publishing that information. So the reason you keep doing the training and you keep changing the media and you keep doing different methods to reach people is that you get more information in and you provide that information to people. And with more information, they can make a better decision. And having that clarity of the regulatory control, where this is where the line stops with the Department of Ag and this is where the line begins with the Pollution Control Agency, we had seed people who had done treated seed calling over which landfill does it go to? Where can we take it? We don't know where to take it. Once the spigot got shut off, going to Mead, Nebraska, once that stopped, they had nowhere to go. So that's why we have this in front of us.
Okay. Mr. Lippert, I'm sorry. Representative Lippert.
Can I just interrupt here? I don't think those of us on the Zoom heard that question. I didn't hear anything.
I'm sorry, everyone. I forgot to turn my microphone on. I will repeat the question.
Please.
Thank you.
Representative Voss, Mr. McBeth, in his testimony, shared what happened at the ethanol plant in Mead, Nebraska, the prosecution that followed. I asked if he was aware of the action the Nebraska legislature took following that event in Mead as well.
Who would like to go with that? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lippert, I'm not specifically aware of the action the Nebraska legislature took in the wake of that, nor am I as familiar with the version of the Pollution Control Agency or the Attorney General or the other environmental regulations that were in place and or fell down to prevent a bad actor from doing what it did in Nebraska.
Follow Mr. up? Chair, mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. McBeth. I have a Associated Press article in front of me from the Omaha Daily Record that says that lawmakers in Nebraska following that event in Mead approved 43-0 legislation to ban the use of treated seed in ethanol plants. And there are farmers quoted in the article saying that this is a bad actor in Nebraska. This seed shouldn't be used for ethanol plants. And the bill is still very important for us to pass. It seems to me that we're trying to do something similar here in Minnesota, saying, clarifying this is not an appropriate use for treated seed and clarifying disposal as well. So I think if Nebraska, legislators in Nebraska can come together in a bipartisan fashion, put this law in place, it makes sense for us to be paying attention and to do the same. That's my comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Thank you very much to all the testifiers. Great discussion. I certainly learned an awful lot. As I said earlier, we weren't privy to a whole lot of this information, because we've not heard these bills in the Senate. They may have heard them, I think, more so in the Ag, and I'm not going to get into a discussion as to whether they belong here or in the Ag, but, as well as CWD and a few other areas. But members, we do have a little bit of time left. Is the Met Council available? I guess they're out of town, so I'll have to wait for a different day again. I guess they're not available. So this is day three. They're unavailable. If the Met Council wishes to testify, Mr. Chair, they're certainly more than welcome to come in one of the up and coming meetings here. So, members, any other questions that you would like to discuss with regards to the bill? What areas of concern you have? You have, as you can see, the DNR here, the MPCA here, other interested parties. I think it's coming a time where we're going to have to move along here now, and I don't know what the agenda for Representative Hansen is going to be for tomorrow. But again, I have no indication from my leadership as far as finances. So it seems to me we can't deal with that, at least at this point. And we are 16 million miles away from each other. But nevertheless, leadership is dealing with those issues right now, as you can probably imagine. And I'm sure they're up against some real tough decisions. I mean, my goodness, I drove around yesterday and went out for dinner with my grandson to just south of Representative Hansen's area there, at $4.24 a gallon for gasoline. I had to go look at it again to see if it was actually true, and it is. And, you know, so that along with the cost of living, all these discussions I think that leadership is having, and I'm not part of it, but I'm assuming it's like, wow, this is really costing the folks a lot of money right now with the inflation and with things like that going up. There's going to be a real discussion as to where this money goes, if they're going to allow it to go to into larger bills, smaller bills. I guess we'd be considered a smaller bill compared to what they're talking about. But the overall discussion, I think, is going to be pretty much focused on what do we do with the nine or whatever there's left, $7 billion, and as to whether they should give that back to the folks so they can afford to buy that expensive gas. But I can go on and on and on about that, members. If you don't have any other questions, I think we'll Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think we will meet tomorrow, but we're not meeting on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. And then I think I don't know if the Senate has passed the LCCMR bill yet. So this room is scheduled for both environment and LCCMR, so we'll have to figure out if that's passed how we operate that. But just for those of you who are looking on the calendar, that's supposed to be in this room in a separate conference committee if that ever happens.
Yeah. And I don't believe there's been any conferees, obviously not selected, so I don't know if anybody in this room would be involved in that, other than Mr. Stanley for sure. He would be involved in that, and I'm sure the staff over here as well. So So with that, members, if you don't
Sir,
have any
further... Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, sorry.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just... Well, that's okay. I was wondering if you have a sense of, like, when we might hear from the discussions in leadership about funding, because I think, you know, we don't have a lot of time left. Do you have any sense of... And I don't know if Chair Hansen has any sense from the House side or not, but Senator Engelbrechtson, if you know, if you've heard anything about when we might hear something, I think that would be helpful to know.
Well, I can't speak for Representative Hansen, but he did say no in my ear. But we're both certainly inquiring with our leadership, and there's nothing in the rules that says any of the members can't check with the leadership. And because we are getting down to the wire here, and decisions have to be made. If we're not going to get any money, then we'll deal with that. If we get some money, we'll deal with that. We need to move along here. So. But again, keep into consideration, this is not a budget year,
And there's a very large discrepancy here. And I think it's going to come down to leadership making the decision. Are we going to spend money on things that we, you know, that were not discussed during the regular budget year? And that's going to be the big consideration. So ask the leadership on your side and prod them if you have to, like I'm doing on a daily basis. And we'll go from there, I guess. Representative Hansen, do you have any comments?
I would just encourage, you know, on the discussion earlier today on some non-budget items, that we could have ongoing discussions on the ski wax with PFAS, that hopefully we could find something. There's some things that are not budgetary that we could find some common ground on. So I would encourage folks to work on those.
Okay, members, seeing nothing, and I'm going to check my screen. Members, we stand adjourned.